1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It is Feltus and Kale. It is presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And our guest today is Melanie Lentz. Melanie is the author of a book entitled Agent Innocent: How the Secret Service Changed My Life. And Melanie, we welcome you to Feltus and Kale. Nice to have you with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it is our pleasure. And it was back in 2007 when I believe you were 22. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, ripe old age of 22.
So we can all do the math, Melanie. We know how old you are now, but you were 22 in 2007. No previous military or law enforcement experience, and you were hired by the Secret Service. How did it all come about?
Oh, my, yes. Well, I was not the little girl that grew up saying she was going to become a Secret Service agent. That wasn't my... I am painfully shy, especially back then, so I'm pretty sure anybody I grew up with would have laughed if I said I wanted to be a Secret Service agent. But when I was in graduate school, it was kind of that time in your life where you really have to kind of hone in on what you want to do after school. And my grandpa's best buddy's daughter, so a very roundabout way, best buddy's daughter was a Secret Service agent, and she did not have military or law enforcement before, and so they were always talking about her crazy workplace adventures and what have you. And my grandpa's the one that said, Mel, you should apply. You were a college athlete and, you know, you're a good student. You could do the job. Well, I ended up applying thinking, I mean, who wouldn't want to be the Secret Service agent with the earpiece and the aviators looking really cool, you know, in the, you know, like the movie. So I applied thinking that I would never hear from them. I met the very minimum qualifications. You had to be 21 with a college degree or equivalent experience like law enforcement or military to apply. And by the time I had applied, I had done some research. I'd read the books. You know, I was totally the academic trying to learn this job. And they called me for the written test. I passed the written test and then the panel interview, the initial interviews. And all that background stuff and polygraph, you know, I just started one, you know, over a 6-month period kind of passing these elements of the application. And I had told myself during this process, I need to know what I do have to offer because I don't have the life experience or the experience, you know, military or law enforcement that they kind of want in that line of work. But I had the attitude of I am trainable and I'm willing to do the work where I'm deficient. And they bought it because that fateful day in June 2007, I got a call from the Los Angeles field office, one of the supervisors there. And he said, Melanie, we have a spot for you in Los Angeles. Do you want it? And if so, you leave in 3 weeks. Pack your bag. So gulp, my life changed.
I guess it did.
Certainly. Yeah. And Melanie, you are one of the youngest women Secret Service agents ever. Tell us about that experience in that context and sort of breaking some of those barriers.
Right. And yeah, they said when I got hired at 22 that I was the youngest female thus far. You know, since I've been there, maybe somebody else was younger, but I highly doubt it. But what really stood out, I think, you know, people say, oh, was it your gender? Because the Secret Service is almost 90% male agents. So I stood out in general just from being a female, but I was also so young. So I felt so out of place that first day at the academy when I'm surrounded by the, you know, the biceps and the military haircuts and the, you know, confidence that I didn't have yet. I didn't know what I was doing. And so there was a bit of a learning curve. I was blessed in training to have a large group of big brothers who looked out for me and knew that I wanted to do well in the job. And so that part, I was blessed to have a great academy class to help me get through that part. But what I found out as a female in law enforcement, there are some things you have to be able to do physically. And I had to, you know, I had done some, you know, training. My academic background is in exercise science. So the physical demands I was able to handle. Plus, I was younger and I recovered better than some of the other guys that were a lot older than me in my class. But I found that once I got out of training, there was a lot I could do that some of the others couldn't do. Like, for example, The Secret Service does financial crime investigations, specifically like counterfeit or credit card fraud investigations, that sort of thing. So somebody who looked about 16 like I did at 22 was able to blend into surveillances during interviews. Sometimes I was more of a calming presence to have a woman there. I actually have kind of a funny story about a counterfeit investigation that wound up in Las Vegas. I was on this surveillance and we wound up in a casino. And so we were just watching. It was a high quality counterfeit. Las Vegas has very good counterfeit detection. And so it was passing some of the Vegas counterfeit detection. So it was a good quality counterfeit. So we were, you know, surveilling this group that was passing it in Vegas. And in the casinos, I kept getting stopped by security in the casinos asking where my mother was. And I was, because they said, honey, you have to be 21 to be in the casino. You know, where are your parents at? And of course, they didn't know what we were there for. We were just following these people, you know, for our case. It wasn't like it was coordinated with the casino or anything. And so I got teased every morning when I went in for my surveillance shift. The guys would say, oh, you better go to the security desk and get your little wristband, little girl, so that they won't stop you and you can do your big agent job. But I found that there were certain things I could do. Or for another example is when Jill Biden came to Los Angeles one time and wanted to go for a run on the beach. But she wanted it to be kind of low key. And I was able to take, she's now the first lady. She wasn't then, but now I was able to take her for a walk on the beach and nobody, or a run on the beach, and nobody knew the wiser. Nobody recognized her. We were able to do that a little discreetly. So there were things I could offer. I had something to offer and I had to kind of recognize that early on, especially being so young.
And Melanie, you know, entering, just going back to that time when you entered the profession, and you mentioned 90% men. What advice would you give to women who are listening who may be entering a profession dominated by men, or who may be in a profession dominated by men?
Yeah. You know, when I was in grad school, I interviewed a bunch of women that were in male-dominated occupations and asked that same exact question. And I think I was given some good advice by one of the older Secret Service agents, actually. I interviewed FBI agent, airline pilot, that kind of stuff. But they told me, don't think that you need to be a man to do that job. You don't need to act like one. You need to, yes, there are certain demands. You know, it's the same badge, same title, same pay grade, same standards. You know, you have certain things you have to be able to do. But I said, I could still be a woman and do the job well, and I can embrace the fact that I am a woman and have something to offer. It's not better or worse. I just have some different skill sets and things that I can offer. And so my advice would be is don't think that you have to be something you're not to fit in or behave differently. It's a matter you have to be able to do this job physically, but you can also still keep that, you know, femininity as well.
Our guest is Melanie Lentz, author of the book Agent Innocent, How the Secret Service Changed My Life. And we've just scratched the surface so far. We have to take a quick break. It's Feldis and Kale here at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com. It's Feldis and Kale. And we are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And our guest is Melanie Lentz, and she has written the book Agent Innocent, How the Secret Service Changed My Life. So you were 22, you looked like 16, and no law enforcement experience, no military experience. So what was your selling point? How did you convince the powers that be that you should be hired by the Secret Service?
Yeah. During the application process, my why do you want this job and why should we hire you question was always asked of me. And I gave the answer that I was the person that wanted to do something really meaningful with my life. I wanted my day job to be for the greater good, if you will. And I was willing to do the work and I was trainable. I said, you know, I said in several of the interviews, why are you going to send me to 8 months of academy training and expect me to know everything going into it? that's the point of teaching me. I'm willing to do the work. I know I'm behind on the life experience, but I will stay after hours. I will do the work to get it done. And I think I know, because I learned after the fact, you know, when I got hired, that that was the reason that they gave me a chance, was that I said I was willing to do the work, and I had nothing in my background that said the otherwise. And so that was my selling point, and I had to deliver.
Yeah, and there must be quite a vetting process involved too, a background check on even candidates for the Secret Service.
Yes. Yeah, there's several processes throughout the application. And so you do the written test. There's an initial interview, which is just to kind of weed out the people that aren't serious. And then they do a panel interview, which is where it's your peers and a supervisor, a little more in depth. There's, you know, a physical background where they talk to everyone you ever knew, and a polygraph. And then they do the final step for me was a home interview, which I laugh now about how silly I must have looked, because most of the time the home interview is with a spouse and children, and it's where they tell the families what they can really expect from the job. It's where nothing, the words aren't minced, and they tell you you're going to miss vacations, holidays, birthdays. You know, they say it's a tough job that's going to require a lot of flexibility on the family's part. Well, my home interview was a little bit different because I still lived at home with my parents. And so these people show up to do this home interview, and it's like me and my mom and dad on the couch. You know, I thought I looked like that little kid that was going to be like, you know, hey, do you want to come see my room? You know, and so I thought I looked so silly that I've got my parents here and this little girl that still lived at home. But I saw it that way. But I learned years later, my mom said that the home interview agent told my parents, oh, she's going to be just fine. So I guess it's kind of a perception thing. I thought I looked silly, like a little kid that wanted a job I was totally unfit for. And they saw something in me I was not really seeing in myself quite so much at the time.
So you were hired, and how much, there has to be a great deal of training involved in you know, all the aspects of the job and what have you. So how long a training period was it?
Right. So all the Secret Service agents go through two different academies. The first one is in Georgia at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And that is where a lot of federal agencies do kind of like a basic training. That was 12 weeks. So my class, for example, was half ICE agent trainees and half Secret Service agent trainees. So you learn, you know, Fourth Amendment, search and seizure, a lot of just basic federal law enforcement stuff, the basic fighting and shooting and all that good stuff. And then once you graduate from that academy, we would go to Maryland, and that training was 18 weeks, and that's at a Secret Service-specific academy there. And that's where we kind of expand upon what you did in Georgia. So you would learn investigating financial crime, counterfeit, and then the big thing is the protection aspect. So you learn how to, you know, drive in motorcades, which is a lot of fun. Those armored cars are a lot of fun to drive through the courses. And you learn how to investigate threats, which, you know, today it's a lot of it is electronic, whether it's Facebook and stuff. And so you learn kind of the nitty-gritty stuff about protection and investigations from a Secret Service standpoint. So a little more specialized and a lot longer. So that's 18 weeks. And once you get done with that, you are assigned to the field, as they say. So I was specifically assigned to Los Angeles. And you spend a few years in the field to kind of learn. Los Angeles had a lot of foreign dignitaries that visited, and they get Secret Service protection. And so we got a lot of protection experience in L.A., which is taking, you know, foreign dignitaries to Disneyland with their kids, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of that. And then after you do a few years in the field, then you'll make that big transfer to Washington, D.C., for example, for the president and vice president detail. That's where we call it, the big show. You learn in the field, and then you go to permanent protection detail with the big guns. And so that's kind of the process of the career, I suppose.
And what about, must be extensive firearms training, I would think.
Absolutely, yes. And we did, you know, you learn how to shoot all kinds of different guns. They carry, you know, obviously your sidearm as an agent. And what it was kind of funny is I grew up trap shooting with my dad.
Ah,
and so when
okay.
we did the shotgun training, they kind of laughed because that gun, you know, that's, you know, has some kick to it. And so I think they thought I had never done it before. And so I just, you know, listened to the instruction. Well, I just blew it away with that part. That portion of training I did really well on. because I laughed. I said, well, I'm used to kind of shooting the moving, you know, the clay target with the trap shooting. But I said, it's a lot easier when it's just standing in one place. So anyways, we did a lot of that training. I mean, we pretty much practiced shooting every day.
Melanie, that, you know, the images that you see on TV with Secret Service, as you mentioned earlier, with the sunglasses, the earpieces, that kind of stuff, I think it's just a sliver, certainly, of the work and the background work that goes into even just a simple event. My wife Erin and I had a house party for then Vice President Joe Biden when he signed the paperwork at the New Hampshire State House for him and then President Barack Obama to run for re-election. And that entire week prior to that house party, I think there was three or four visits, conversations with the Secret Service and, you know, the, all kinds of planning. And, you know, can you walk through some of the advanced work? Again, like what people see on TV is just a sliver of the kind of work that goes into an event. Can you talk through some of that advanced work to the extent that you can share?
Yeah, absolutely. The advanced work is where the real work happens. You know, there's kind of this proactive protection and then a reactive protection. So the proactive part is what you're describing. The agents that come out a week before, their briefings, they're making diagrams, creating a security plan to ultimately control access. It's a big access control balance. You know, who needs access granted, who might need it limited, denied, revoked, that sort of thing. And you're coordinating with local law enforcement for motorcade routes, maybe possible closures, any construction that's going on. You know, that every little movement has to be coordinated and planned, and everyone you're going to interact with in that process has to be vetted and controlled in some sort of access, at some sort of access point. And really, honestly, that was my favorite part of the job. I loved advanced work. I mean, people probably would laugh at me because I lived for that stuff. I loved it so much. But that's that proactive part. You create a security plan, and then the reactive part is the agents in the motorcades that get all the, you know, the photos in the press. They're the reactive ones. The real work happens with that group that's coming out ahead of time. And another big part of the advanced work is also monitoring any threats. And, you know, with President Barack Obama, that was my first year at a training, was 2008, his first campaign. And that was there was a lot of threats associated with that campaign and a high volume. And so there was a lot of work in kind of going through these threats. What's legitimate? Do we need to make any, you know, arrests, that sort of thing? And so that's part of the advanced work process as well, is kind of monitoring, you know, what's coming in and if there's any adjustments that need to be made in terms of the security plan. So I love making the diagrams and, you know, coordinating bomb sweeps. And, you know, you have to know all kinds of things. You need to know, you know, what the response is for that building's fire alarm. Is the fire, you know, department automatically dispatched or not? I mean, there's so many little things that you need to know as an advanced agent so that if something ever happens, you already know the answers to some things you'll need to know in the moment. Hopefully you never have to do any of the emergency prep, you know, actually implement the emergency plan, but that you've done your work ahead of time to make sure the visit is smooth on game day.
Well, thank you so much for all your service to the country. And right now you are a writer, a blogger, mm-hmm. a motivational speaker, and a fitness pro. Out of all those different roles, what's your favorite role to right now and what you're doing out there?
Yeah, I have found that the writing and the speaking is something I have enjoyed. You know, my personal story as an agent involves protecting other people better than I was protecting myself. And as with many jobs, I said yes to work and no to my family, and that caught up with me. And that's kind of where the Agent Innocent and the memoir came about, was that I had to learn a lot of lessons the hard way. I started off strong, but I made some bad choices and bad habits. And I found that there are so many little things about protecting others that applied to protecting myself inside and out, where I was letting certain things control me and have excessive access to me, like my job, when in reality I should have been granting more access to my family and my loved ones. And that kind of fine, delicate balance, like making sure that I know I'm worth protecting. And I found that that message has resonated a lot with the younger crowd. And so I really enjoyed talking to, you know, high school, college students about being so young and doing something big with my life at a young age, and how I wish I had learned some of this protection stuff about in my own life sooner. And so that's kind of where I find my message is most meaningful. And, you know, just the satisfaction and knowing that I'm encouraging others to keep going for their dreams, but keep their own protection in check as well.
And you do detail in your book what a toll your job did take on your personal life.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is a tough job, as with many. You know, I struggled with the work-life balance and all that good stuff, just like anybody else does at some point. I just was blessed at such a young age to be able to learn some big life lessons, yes, the hard way, but in kind of a unique environment that people my age and, you know, women my age had not been involved in up till then. So that was, I found that it resonates more, and I have enjoyed being able to share my story, the good, the bad, the ugly, and a lot of the funny, and have it make an impact on others.
So what was your reaction when you found out that you were being assigned to protect former First Lady Nancy Reagan?
Right. Well, at the time, my personal life had kind of fallen apart, like I had said, you know, briefly a minute ago. And I was going through a divorce at the time and was very depressed and down about that, understandably. And I was due to go to D.C., which I loved my job, and that was kind of what I wanted. I mean, who wants to, you know, that's why you become an agent, is to protect the president. That's what you want to do. And I was in a position where me and my spouse at the time could not move. And so there was an opening at Nancy Reagan's detail because she was in the Los Angeles area. And so I took that almost very resentful. I was very resentful and angry that I took that position, honestly, because I wasn't able to go to D.C. But it was the first life decision or career decision I made for the betterment of my personal life. Now, it was too little too late for the marriage, but it was at a time in my life where I probably needed to not be traveling so much. I needed to be addressing those demons in my personal life. I had not. And so sometimes things just work out where you're where you need to be at the moment you need to be. And I credit Nancy Reagan being on her detail with kind of that catalyst to big change in my life. Because after she passed away, I ended up leaving the Secret Service a few months after that. But it was one of those things where I realized I didn't like who I was becoming. That I had to revert back to that 22-year-old person that knew that what kind of person she wanted to be. And I had to do a lot of soul searching, and unfortunately the best move for me was to leave that job I love and start over. And I'm not sure I would have had the guts to make that decision had I have gone to D.C. because I loved that job so much. There was so much happening in my personal life when Nancy Reagan passed away that it forced me to kind of, okay, you need to regroup, and how are we going to address all of these things that you've been neglecting for so long?
So what was it like to be around Nancy Reagan? Did you get to know her very well?
You know what? We did not. I did not get to know her well. She was in her 90s when I was there, so she wasn't traveling as much as she was when she was younger. And so it was a very quiet detail. But so I didn't have, you know, we didn't sit around and have coffee or chit chat. I spoke with her from a professional standpoint. She was always kind to me when I did have to speak to her. You know, she has that very, you know, very direct personality, which I grew to appreciate. She always just knew exactly what she wanted, and she just said it, and let's do our business and be on about our day. And so I appreciated her. I think I got to know her, if you will, more after she passed away, as I remember being at her funeral and people reading things that she had written or sharing their stories, and it was all things that I didn't know. You know, I'd been protecting somebody I knew very little about. And I think kind of reflecting on her legacy made me realize that there were some things about me that I needed to change. And regardless of political opinions and, you know, scandals and what have you, Mrs. Reagan's legacy was one of fierce love, was kind of the theme of her funeral. And I realized that I was an angry, resentful, depressed, divorced person who had no clue how she lost her way. And so I think learning about her after the fact made me take a big inner look at my own life.
And in taking a look at your own life, as you mentioned, you know, protecting yourself, going from protecting others and making sure you protect yourself. Melanie, you're a fitness pro as well. You know, that's a key part of people staying healthy. What advice would you give to folks out there who, you know, maybe don't work out, but, you know, are looking to work out to try to improve their lives and be healthier? What simple steps could they take? What simple exercises, et cetera, can folks take that are listening?
Right. Well, you know what? I learned as somebody with an educational background in fitness and then a Secret Service or law enforcement experience is I've learned that we really just don't like to be uncomfortable. And getting uncomfortable is part of life, and it's stuff we kind of avoid. And I learned as a Secret Service agent in training when there are some physical demands that you have to accomplish. And I actually was one of the only females to pass the rescue swimmer course with the Secret Service, which is known to be exceptionally difficult. And I learned that you always have a little bit more. You can do some. You can do a little bit more than you usually give your credit yourself credit for. And I found that that mentality that I learned, you know, going through rescue summer school and just being, I mean, dead tired all the time and physical demands are just excruciating. I learned that that philosophy that you always have a little bit more translates into a lot of the way I train my clients is that sometimes you have one more rep in there. And sometimes it's just about showing up. That's the first part. You know, you just have to show up that first day is the hardest part. And yes, it's going to be uncomfortable. But in the long run, you're going to pay figuratively and literally for your health one way or another. It's just a matter of when you want to do it now for and have a better quality of life and feel better, or later with, you know, some preventable medical ailments that could have been avoided earlier on. It's about when do you want to be uncomfortable, now or later? And I found that that kind of is my philosophy.
How therapeutic was it for you to write the book? Was that part of therapy?
Yes. You know, I said about the book that I needed to write it whether or not people read it. And I found that I think it turned out better because that was my mentality. I didn't write what I thought people wanted to hear. You know, the scandalous tell-all. I wrote the personal story as it related to my job. And I found that it was healing and helped me recognize a lot of ways I needed to change my life. And so I actually have a workbook coming out May 1st. It's called Advanced Work. Speaking of Advanced Work. And it's a workbook kind of geared towards more the younger age group where it goes through those protection lessons I learned, but it's a way for you to apply it to your own life. And so I'm kind of excited for that follow-up to Agent Innocent because it expands upon what I've learned even after the fact. And so that comes out May 1st, a little workbook called Advanced Work. So, yeah, if your listeners want to check it out, it'll be out on Amazon on May 1st.
So you're a two-time author now.
Two-time, yeah.
and I'm sure probably more on the way as well.
I hope so. I would love to take a stab at fiction. You know, I have so much content I could write about and so many funny experiences on the, you know, as an insider with the Secret Service that I'm sure there's some comedy and some fun in terms of a fiction thing. So I think that's probably going to be my next book.
So how can people follow you? Are you on YouTube at all?
No, my website is MelanieLentz.com and okay. Social media, Melanie Lentz on Facebook. And Melanie Lentz, author on Instagram. So that's kind of how you can reach me. You can contact me via the website and in terms of booking any speaking gigs if you're interested in that. That'll be media@MelanieLentz.com.
Well, so there are many ways that people can get in touch with you. And we are certainly glad that we did. It's a very interesting and intriguing story. And we look forward to perhaps having you on again here on Feldis and Kale and talk about the new book that's coming out on May 1st.
I would love that.
Very good. Well, Melanie, thanks so much. You've been a delight, and we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Have a lovely rest of your day.
You as well. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
That's Melanie Lentz and the author of Agent Innocent, How the Secret Service Changed My Life. And terrific, upbeat personality.
No doubt about it. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah, and we look forward to another magnificent, upbeat personality joining us in just a few minutes as Amy Hall will join us, the executive director of the Granite State Dairy Promotion. And on this April 22nd, it is Earth Day.
It is.
Yes.
Happy Earth Day, Ken.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You know how long Earth Day has been around? How long we've specified this date to celebrate planet Earth and to help protect planet Earth, make people aware of how they
50,
can...
50 years?
It's actually 51.
51.
Okay. Last year, 2020...
Was 50.
Was 50, and now it's 51. I had not realized until I actually looked at it this morning that it was that old that we were celebrating. So I was in high school when the whole thing started. I don't think I can remember when it began, but I certainly was around and in high school at the time. So we celebrate Earth Day today, and we have to be aware of how we can help our planet survive. Feldis and Kale, we are glad to have you along with us here on 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. We are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. 103.9 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Feldis and Kale, proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And speaking of Granite State Dairy Promotion, right now, even as we speak,
right now,
we have the executive director of Granite State
this
Dairy Promotion, the one, the only, Amy Hall. Amy, how are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you gentlemen doing?
Great. Thank you again for joining us. It's great to have you.
This is an all female guest show.
I love that.
You were preceded today by Melanie Lentz, who was the youngest female ever hired at the time. This was back in 2007. Youngest female Secret Service agent. How about that?
Cut it out. She is the coolest. Yeah. That's great. Yeah.
There you go. Well, you'll have to go back in the archives and listen to that segment as well.
Actually, Ken, all week, all woman guest show.
That's true, isn't it? Yes.
On Tuesday, we had Kayla Montgomery from Planned Parenthood and Anne-Marie Timmons from the new New Hampshire News Bulletin.
Yeah. We're not discriminating against men here or anything like that, but it seems like recently most of our guests have been women.
All the interesting people are women, Ken.
You know, I would agree with that, Dan. I would really agree with that. And certainly one of the most interesting is Amy Hall, who can expound on any number of topics. I mean, generally speaking, we talk about dairy and its impact on New Hampshire and all the great work that our dairy farmers do. And, you know, we talked about last week some misconceptions, I think, that people have about the impact cows have on our environment. And we learned a lot there. And today, Dan, Amy is going to talk about antibiotics and hormones. I mean, you know, this is like being in a classroom. We're getting all this knowledge for free here on Feldis and Kale.
And it is my pleasure. I love to educate the masses when it comes to things like this. And I had, you know, discussed previously that prior to having this job, the only thing I knew about the dairy industry was how to play barn tag at the local dairy farm.
But you were very good at it, I understand.
I mean, it's also where I developed an extreme fear of spiders. Have you ever seen a barn spider?
Oh,
if
yeah.
Your answer is no, be happy. If your answer is yes, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Well, I guess Dan knows what you're talking about. I'm not exactly sure, but I guess it can't be a very pleasant experience.
No, not at all.
Okay.
But, you know, and since I didn't know anything about the dairy industry, you know, a part of my interview, I remember them asking me, how would you handle it if somebody asked you about antibiotics in milk? And I was left speechless because I was thinking, this is a tricky question, because they wouldn't be asking me this if there wasn't some sort of surrounding controversy. And my first instinct, I was 100% certain going into that milk did contain antibiotics. It was everywhere. It was all over the news. It was, you know, avoid milk because of this, avoid milk because of hormones. Well, come to find out, the answer to that question is very simple, and dairy farmers know it. The industry knows it, is that milk does not contain antibiotics. It is illegal. Per the law, milk cannot contain antibiotics. So all milk, it applies to both conventional and organic, is antibiotic-free, regardless of how it's labeled in the store. So this is sort of what drives me a little nuts, right? Picture yourself in the dairy aisle, and you see jugs of milk, and they're labeled antibiotic-free. But then there's a jug next to it. It's typically maybe a store brand or, you know, some other label that doesn't have that on there. So what does that suggest psychologically to a consumer? that milk does contain antibiotics, because one is labeled "we don't have it" and the other one isn't labeled at all. So that's created quite a bit of confusion. And the reason that this came about, okay, is, and I like to break this down simply, it's a sales tactic, right? It's marketing. Sometimes the industry can be its own worst enemy. I've said that from day one, and I'll continue to say it. So when they started to label that as "we can make more sales," you know, with this, you know, new fun label, food label, you know, we saw sales increase. But unfortunately, what that did was it created a lot of confusion in the minds of consumers.
It would, yeah, no question about it, because that would be the perception of most. If you see, yeah, you know, two cartons of milk on the shelf, and you know, one says antibiotic, no antibiotics, and the other doesn't say anything at all, then you would think, oh yeah, this one must be loaded with antibiotics, right? But that's not true. So Amy is here to clear up any misconception. There's no antibiotics in milk. Period.
Exactly. And so I want to expand on that a little bit, and I want to let the public know that, you know, sick cows are sometimes treated with antibiotics, mm-hmm, just like sick people are. You know, if you have a child and they're not feeling well and you bring them to the doctor or apply that to yourself or any other human being, you know, you would, in order to help them get better, put them on antibiotics. But you only do that when it's necessary to treat specific illnesses. And sometimes cows, just like people, they don't feel well or they get sick. And so what happens at that point is if a dairy producer and, you know, in conjunction with their vet decide that, you know, this cow would benefit from that, that specific cow is entirely removed from the herd until they recover and the antibiotics are completely out of their system. They're milked separately. They're kind of kind of ostracized from the herd, right? You stay over there because your milk can't touch the system. So during that time, their milk is withheld from the market and it never, ever, ever enters the food supply. And how do we know this? Milk is tested for antibiotics at each stage of the delivery process. So first, by the dairy farmer. Next, the big milk truck driver, the processor, tanker truck gets to the farm, and once the milk arrives at the plant, another sample is taken and tested. So it doesn't even go into the plant until the plant tests it. And here's what happens, guys. There are extremely strict financial and regulatory penalties for farmers if their milk doesn't pass these tests. It doesn't matter if it enters the system or not. It will taint an entire tank of milk. And then that entire tank has to be dumped out. And guess who pays for it? The dairy farmer.
Sure.
An entire tractor trailer load of milk. Mm. So it doesn't make sense to be arbitrarily treating cows with antibiotics. You know, dairy farmers aren't walking through and just doing that. It doesn't make sense, number one, because, you know, you destroy immunity when you do that, makes it harder for cows to get better. And it's extremely expensive and it's illegal. So there you have it. That's the scoop on antibiotics, folks.
No antibiotics in milk, period.
Exactly. Period. Feel free, feel happy, whether it be organic or conventional, no matter how it's labeled on the grocery store shelf. Everybody, take a second, do a big exhale. You can feel good that all milk is antibiotic-free.
All right. We're going to talk hormones in just a minute, but we have to take a break. It's Feldis and Kale. We're joined by Amy Hall, Granite State Dairy Promotion, our lead sponsor here on Feldis and Kale, and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers on 103.9, 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. Welcome back, Feldis and Kale, here on WKXL and nhtalkradio.com. We are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Amy Hall here, the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion. We talked about no antibiotics in milk. Let's talk about hormones.
That's another big one.
Are hormones given to cows to increase milk production?
There are very, very few farms across the nation. I would say we're down to a handful, tops that will give their cows injections of hormones, also known as RBST. Now, this has been deemed completely safe by science, the FDA, you name it. It's been tested over and over again. But the dairy industry is really very good in that they listen to consumers and they're learning that, you know what, it doesn't matter how many studies show that there really isn't an issue with this. Our consumers don't want it. So we are going to eliminate that. And when I say a handful of farms across the nation, I can't name those farms specifically because, one, I don't know. But I can tell you this. Here in the Northeast and in New England, there is not a milk co-op who will pick up milk from a dairy farmer who uses artificial hormones in their milk. So that's another thing that our consumers can feel confident about. We always do things right here in the Northeast anyway, so this should be no surprise. And the thing about this is that, you know, are there hormones in milk? Yes, there are. But hormones are just simply chemical messengers, right? So those are often proteins, and they're produced naturally in both plant and animal products. So from celery to salmon to wheat and chicken, there are no such thing. There's no such thing as a hormone-free food. Hormones allow for life, and you need that to live. So anything that's living contains hormones. So there's no such thing. So yes, does milk have hormones in it? Absolutely. But so does the flour. So does the wheat. So does the salmon. So do the fruits. So do the vegetables. It's just, it's the life cycle. It's the natural process of things.
So that's natural hormones, Amy. But getting back to the artificial hormones or the injections or whatever you mentioned, that is not a practice that is going on widespread, and certainly not in New Hampshire dairy producers, correct?
Exactly, Dan, and thank you for reiterating that. And I wouldn't be surprised that, you know, within the next year or two, you will see the practice completely 100% eliminated. You know, it just, it keeps, you know, we have co-ops everywhere now that more and more are saying, we don't want that milk, we're not picking up that milk. And if the co-op says no, then you know what happens? The processing plant doesn't want it. So there's no more incentive for dairy producers to do this because consumers really are central to everything that most businesses who serve people, specifically food, you know, target in on. And when the consumers are screaming, no, we don't want this, no, we don't want this, then we're going to say, okay, we hear you. We're going to stop. So yes, please feel good that here in the Northeast, up and down the East Coast, there is not a worry that our cows are being injected with artificial hormones. Hormones are never added to milk either. It's one of the simplest foods that you can buy.
So if we've learned nothing else on this program today, you don't have to worry about antibiotics or hormones in milk.
Artificial hormones.
Artificial hormones, yes. Artificial. You don't have to worry about those. Or antibiotics. And so I think we've learned a lot today.
We have learned a ton. These interviews have been amazing.
It's funny. There are so many milk choices these days, and some aren't real milk. They call themselves milk, but they're really not milk. We can get into that on another day. But really, you know, and I talked about this with Amy a long time ago. You know, you have the 1% milk, the 2% milk, the skim milk.
Right. Yep.
But in regular milk, Amy, regular milk, whole milk, What's the fat percentage?
Oh, I love this because it blows people's mind. I love this, Ken, and I'm so glad you remembered this, and you always hold on to this.
Yeah.
So if whole milk were labeled the same way as any other milk, so your skim 1%, 2%, whole milk would be 3%.
3%, yeah.
3%. So whole milk is legitimately, when it comes down to it, to verbalize it in a way people could understand, 97% fat-free.
Oh, there you go. So that's the way they should advertise it. I think really, 97% fat-free.
Well, that's the way I advertise it. So I don't know what everybody else is doing.
This show has more fat than that, so, you know.
That's definitely the case.
And that's just me.
Well, yeah, I know we're here, too. Yeah. But in the Feltus household, definitely drink whole milk, without a doubt. Iris and Josie will accept nothing less, nothing. Even if it's 1% less to 2%. Right.
We've learned a lot on the show today, Amy. Thank you so much, and we will chat with you again next week.
It is always a pleasure. And go girls, right? You guys are just leading the way for us ladies. We appreciate you.
Oh, it is our pleasure. Our pleasure, Amy. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Feldeson Kale, we've done it again, Dan. We fooled them once again. Sponsored by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com.